It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll learn about the Hodag of Rhinelander and some other mythical creatures from Wisconsin folklore. First, primaries are coming to the state next week, and Wisconsin is getting a lot of love this time around. All five major party presidential candidates are appearing in Wisconsin ahead of the April 5th primary. Hillary Clinton is speaking right now, I think about three blocks from here on UW-Madison's campus. John Kasich, Ted Cruz both have events this evening. Kasich in Madison, Cruz a rally in Rothschild. Donald Trump making his first Wisconsin appearance in Janesville tomorrow. That's the schedule. Bernie Sanders continues his tour in Appleton and West Allis tomorrow. Wisconsin's 42 delegates have become critical for all three Republican candidates. For Trump, trying to keep his lead. For Kasich and Cruz, trying to keep Trump short of that majority, have an open convention. On the Democratic side, Wisconsin is a major stop on the Sanders campaign since picking up momentum after winning in Washington, Hawaii, and Alaska. He still lags Hillary Clinton in the total delegate count. Here to tell us more about Wisconsin's role in the presidential election is Charlie Jacobs, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Charlie, we've seen a lot of attention for general elections in the presidential race before. We don't usually see this much action on the primary side, do we?
Not particularly. I mean, we're late enough in the season that in most years, we sort of know where the winds are blowing well enough that we're sort of an afterthought in the process. But, I mean, both sides are, I think, sort of deeply enmeshed in the debate still about who's going to be the candidate. We keep talking about sort of presumptive candidates, but every time we seem to have a primary, a caucus in another state, there's still always that question mark kind of lingering. So I think that we become a much bigger player this year, and not just because of the delegates, but I think because of what the outcome might reflect from this particular primary. We're a swing state. We've been a swing state in the last couple of elections. We're in many ways like Ohio as a bellwether. And I think that pundits and those who like to prognosticate about November elections will take what they see in this election next Tuesday to try to get some sense about how voters might be playing out when we get down to the final two choice.
Yeah, in the momentum conversation, we are the only game in town next Tuesday. So a lot of candidates, no matter how many delegates are at play, they're looking for the story that, hey, they're winning, they're proving that they can win.
That's true. And I think because we're still considered one of those Rust Belt states where you still have sort of old guard Democrats and strong union support and all of the events that unfolded because of Act 10, I think we're looking at that on the Democratic side and whether or not those kind of moderate Democrats might be defecting towards Republican candidates much like they did during the Reagan years. So I think there's just lots to chew on here, and I think the national media is going to take this maybe for more than it's worth, but at least they're going to get a clearer picture about how one of these sort of purple states might react in the general election in November.
So all the candidates are campaigning in Wisconsin over the next week. We're seeing ads, some attack ads from outside groups. 8 days out, have most of us made up their minds already?
Most of us probably have. You know, we have a pretty strong core of independents in this state that are often very unpredictable. Independents typically are. But, you know, what we're seeing in some of the most recent polls, Emerson had a poll out the other day, is that there seems to be a dividing line in the state. It seems like we have almost a west versus east kind of divide. Trump seems to be doing very well in the western counties. So too does Bernie Sanders, and Bernie Sanders is pulling very well in the northeast components of the state. And Clinton and Cruz are doing much better in the eastern side, and Hillary especially down in the sort of southeastern corner of the state. So it might do them in the last hours as they run up to this primary, stick to a regional cohort and see whether or not they can pull some votes over there.
That's interesting, Charlie. Does that tell us something about politics in Wisconsin? Are people, you know, we've got that southeast area, a lot of the population there, a lot of the government there. Are people in the outstate area feeling particularly disaffected?
That may be the case. I mean, just what we know about the demographics of the state, you know, more highly populated in the southern and eastern quadrant of the state, probably sort of more establishment. We have more government there. The state capital is there, more densely populated. So it might be that the establishment candidates are more attractive to that population. Possibly in the northeastern corner, we have a couple of institutions of higher education that might have an effect on it. But it might be the sort of the more rural nature of the West, the kind of message that's coming from Sanders and from Trump, the sort of populism might be resonating more with those individuals than it does in sort of the more traditional urban areas of the state.
Talking to political scientist Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College, looking at the presidential primary coming up 8 days, all the candidates showing up in Wisconsin this week. Let's take each party in turn now, Charlie. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders comes out of the weekend with some momentum. Hillary Clinton, as I mentioned, the delegate lead around the country. How big a deal is Wisconsin for Bernie Sanders' campaign in particular?
I think if he can maintain that momentum that he had from the most the three most recent races, I think he's got a good case to make with the unpledged delegates. And he was making this case a little bit earlier in the week when he was saying that they'll switch. Once I start to gain some more traction, they'll start to switch and they'll abandon Hillary. And that's always an issue, because until they're given a reason to, these unpledged delegates can change their vote any time that they want. Right now, the safe bet seems to be Hillary Clinton. So if he can win, and not win by a small margin, but if he can Clinton, I think that he can start to make that case, and that makes it a little dicier for Clinton as she goes into the convention, whether or not all those unpledged, or what we often call superdelegates, whether or not they're going to stick with what they perceive to be the front runner, or maybe go with the challenger. So that's going to be an interesting question as we move forward.
And the storyline in a lot of states has been Hillary Clinton does well in states with a large African-American Democratic population. Bernie Sanders does well among white liberals. We've got both kinds of voters here in Wisconsin, so how does that play out?
Well, a small population of ethnic and racial minorities in the state, so that may not play to the advantage of Hillary Clinton. And the other question, and this is one that we can't forget, especially after what we saw recently in Arizona, is, you know, for someone like Clinton, who may be expecting to get those votes from those populations, this is going to be one of the first major elections where we have voter ID. And there's always been a worry and a suspicion that the voter ID law is going to impact individuals from racial and ethnic minority groups more than whites. And that might actually depress the voter turnout for her if there's any issues related to voter ID. And that's not to say that there's an intentional suppression of votes, but just that they do not come prepared with their ID or don't have a valid ID. So that's an issue that we could see play out. And Arizona saw this because of the number of polling stations that they had open during their recent primary and how it affected people who couldn't wait in line for the hours it took to cast their ballot. So that could really be an issue for Clinton. We'll have to see what the returns look like.
On the Republican side, I was looking at the political prognostication site 538.com. Depending on how they slice it, Trump is leading Cruz, or Cruz is leading Trump. Kasich, he had a 9 or 10% chance of winning the state himself. What's going to determine how that Republican side comes out?
It's really, this has been such a quirky election season that, I mean, I think most of these prognostications are kind of, they're just sort of guesses in the wind. It's really so difficult to get a real sense of what is pushing and pulling the voters in a particular direction. And what makes it even more difficult for Wisconsin is we haven't had much polling here, so it's really difficult to tell. I mean, we had a Marquette poll that came out in the end of February, but that was before we lost a couple of candidates in the GOP race. And the last couple were very small samples. So it's really hard to get a sense, but the last two polls that came out had Cruz up a little bit. And it may be that we're finally getting to a water's edge for most of the public, and the rhetoric of Trump is sort of catching up with him, especially some of those super PAC ads that have been airing about sort of what a vote for someone like Kasich would mean, maybe entrenching more delegates for someone like Trump. So I think that what we're going to have to see is whether or not the public is really paying attention to the foothold that Trump has made for himself in the delegate race. And there might be some fear among those who at first listened hard to his ideas and took him seriously, but might now be sort of taking the foot off the pedal and thinking about a different way to turn, depending on what other candidates might be attractive to them.
And Trump has been making the rounds on Wisconsin's Republican talk radio shows, not getting a warm reception from the hosts there, who are often, you know, friendly to conservative politicians. Is that an indication that more than just the mainstream Republican establishment is going to turn against Trump?
It may also just be the territory he's in. As I like to explain to my students a lot, a Republican in Connecticut is going to be a lot different from a Republican in Texas. And you can't treat every state alike and assume you're going to have an audience that's friendly to everything you say. And Trump has had his problems when he's faced the media. He has been sort of unprepared because he has sort of a boilerplate speech or a boilerplate response to so many of the issues that he's asked about. And when pressed hard, he often stumbles. He stumbled with the Washington Post. And I think the conservative talk radio show hosts, although we like to sort of lump them into sort of one brand, often have their own very distinct voices. And if given the opportunity, I think they're going to challenge not just Trump, but any one of the candidates on the stances that they have and the positions that they're going to take. And I just think Trump ran into a fan blade here that he wasn't really expecting. He was probably expecting the soft touch again, like he often gets. And he couldn't talk his way out of it like he typically does.
We'll leave it there for now. Charlie, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Charlie Jacobs, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Norbert College, looking at Wisconsin's role in the presidential election with next Tuesday's primary. Practical jokes and hoaxes are par for the course on April Fool's Day. More than a century ago, an elaborate hoax helped form the identity of one northern Wisconsin town. Emily Bright has the story.
The year is 1893. Eugene Shepherd, a respected timber cruiser, stumbles into a logging camp and begins the story of his life. He has encountered the great black hodag.
Ah, a ferocious-looking beast, with spikes all the way down its entire length of its body, with a fistful of those needle-sharp pointed spears at the end of its tail.
That's Jerry Scheidel, former Rhinelander mayor who's portrayed Shepherd in reenactments. Shepherd led a group of lumbermen into the woods to capture the beast with dynamite and returned with only charred remains. A photograph of the reenacted kill was published widely.
And people say, but it only eats white bulldogs on Sunday. Balderdash. It eats everything from bullfrogs to snakes and enjoys an oxen every now and then. And on occasion, it has been said, has a taste for human flesh.
Shepherd was a prankster and a spendthrift. In one side business, he sold perfumed moss through the mail.
He also, when he had a creditor knock on his door, he'd stuff a bar of soap in his mouth, and he'd lather it up. And then he'd turn around, and he'd kind of snarl at the people, and he'd be foaming out of their mouth. And they'd just run, because they didn't know if he was rabid or not at the time.
But the hodag story was different. Shepherd kept it up for years.
He found the hodag, he captured the hodag, and then he kept the hodag in his barn.
People came from all over to see it.
So he'd have a nice suit of clothes on, he'd go downstairs, and when he got around the corner and disappeared from sight, the commotion was horrendous. There was growling and snarling and snapping and breaking and ripping and tearing. And then after a minute or two or three, he'd come running back up the stairs. His suit of clothes was just in absolute tatters. And he would tell the people, I'm really sorry. I can't show you the hodag today. He's angry.
Soon he was making the county fair circuit.
Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, step right up. Come see the great antediluvian monster of the north, the great black hodag.
Inside a dark tent, you could just make out a creature.
The eyes were glowing green, and the nostrils would flare red when the thing would exhale, and it also had a horrendous stench.
His sons worked behind the scenes, making the monster move. Shepherd earned up to $500 in a weekend, which meant up to 5,000 viewers were paying their dime to come. It's got to be a thrill to pull that off time and again, or at least to entertain people enough that they leave happy. I wonder if it got tiring.
He kept it up until the Smithsonian sent a reporter up here who refused to be duped. And then he had to, of course, admit.
But obviously, the joke still stands.
Rhinelander still has the hodag as its mascot for the city and for the high school. We're hodags.
Hodag statues line downtown Rhinelander like a cow parade with fangs. Any town can claim a real creature for its mascot, Scheidel says. Thanks to Gene Shepherd, Rhinelander, Wisconsin is unique and proud of it.
Don't mess with the hodag.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org. The Rhinelander Hodeg isn't the only mythical creature we hear about in Wisconsin. Joining us now to talk more about some of the other strange creatures from Wisconsin folklore is Chad Lewis, a paranormal researcher, author, and lecturer. Chad, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, we're at the part of your resume that focuses on what's called cryptozoology, Chad. Can you tell us what that is?
Yes, that is the study of hidden animals, animals that science says do not exist. Skeptics say they can exist, yet every year, hundreds of people in Wisconsin are coming face-to-face with these creatures.
So what are some of the other creatures? We just heard about the Hodeg. What are some of the other ones that we hear about here in the state?
Well, I love, with summer coming up, finally, sea serpent stories. And Wisconsin had or maybe has, more sea serpents than anywhere else in the world. Dozens of lakes, rivers, and streams were thought to be inhabited by these gigantic aquatic beasts. And many of them, like in Geneva Lake, are still thought to be there. Many people still see these things and can't explain them.
So when you hear about one of these creatures of folklore, not something you'll find at your local zoo, how do you go about trying to verify it, to try to see it yourself?
First thing is to interview the witness, see what they actually saw. But you have to actually go to these places. You have to put your feet in Geneva Lake, dangle them a little bit to see what people are actually seeing. And then if you think there's something to it, some credibility, you may want to launch an expedition. Last summer, I launched a houseboat with Noah Voss, where we lived on the houseboat for many nights in Lake Pepin in search of Pepe the lake monster, which also has a $50,000 reward attached to it.
And how did it go? We talked to you, I think, just before you went out on Lake Pepin.
Yes, we used underwater sonar, we used underwater cameras, we had fishing equipment, we jumped in using ourselves as bait, but luckily or unluckily, Pepe did not make an appearance while we were there, which is common for a lot of these stories of these monsters, that you can collect dozens, if not hundreds of reports of these, but oftentimes when you're out searching for it, you come up empty-handed.
Well, whether or not we believe these things exist or remain skeptical, a story like the Hodeg, I mean, it's fun, even if it's not a real deal. It's fun to have that as a part of your local heritage.
It is. And I always say for a lot of these creatures that people not take the word of any expert, that they go out and explore for themselves, go out into Wisconsin Lake, start walking the woods and seeing if you believe that these monsters are actually there, and maybe you might encounter one yourself.
Well, you sent us a list of some other ones. I want to get into a couple. The Birdman of Mauston. Tell us about the Birdman.
Very unique. We get a lot of reports of similar-looking creatures, but the Birdman of Mauston seems to be much different. It happened when a gentleman called many years ago and said that his grandmother used to talk about a giant man-like bird that would sit up on the cliffs surrounding Mauston, and it was the size of a human male, but it seemed to have more of like chicken-looking legs and these feathers, very thick feathers all over his body, and the woman was terrified of it. And he posted it to our website, and many others in the Mauston area came forward saying they too had seen something that, in all accounts, kind of resembled the Mothman figure out of Point Pleasant, West Virginia, that a lot of people would recognize as from the movie and the book, you know, this giant bat-like creature with glowing red eyes.
And then from the Birdman to the Devil Dogs of Meridian. This is one I don't think I've heard of before or talked to you about before, Chad, the Devil Dogs.
Yes, there's an old island that's thought to be haunted by a girl, Mary Dean, that drowned there. But the legend is that if you're brave enough or foolish enough to go out there, you might encounter some of these devil dogs, or hellhounds as they're known. They're large black dogs with glowing red or green eyes. They're nearly transparent, and many cultures believe that they actually do the devil's bidding, that they're a harbinger of death, meaning that if you're unlucky enough to see one of these devil dogs, it means you or someone within the community is going to die very shortly.
Well, then why would you go out looking for that, Chad?
Well, I think the excitement of it. In the day and age we live in where a lot of the businesses look the same, a lot of the hotels and everything looks the same, it's a rite of passage for many people, and it's a test of bravery. And it's excitement for people to go out and say, I can sit on the haunted mausoleum for longer than you. And it's a sense of adventure. And I think a lot of people are craving that.
And one more that I also haven't heard of, the mysterious beast of Eau Claire.
Yes, my hometown has been inhabited by this mysterious creature. In the early 2000s, about a month apart from one another, I received two reports from women driving home on the outskirts of Eau Claire, which gets very rural very quick, about 11 p.m. when they saw what appeared to be something the size of a bear but shaped more like a wolf, and it was heavily muscled, and they thought that this thing was going to harm them, so they drove off as fast as they could. And I started researching this and dug up some old accounts from the early 1900s in Eau Claire newspapers that talked about the same creature terrifying farmers and following kids home at night and devouring many livestock. So this creature, whatever it may be, seems to have been here for over 100 years.
We'll leave it there for now, Chad. Happy searching this spring and summer.
Hey, keep an eye out.
That's Chad Lewis. He's a paranormal researcher, author, and lecturer. His website is unexplainedresearch.com. A terrorist attack in Pakistan yesterday killed at least 70 people, injured hundreds more. The suicide bomb explosion detonated in a park in the city of Lahore, and Reuters reported that many of the casualties included women and children. The news agency also said a faction of the Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack, saying Christians were the main target. The tragic attack did lead some newscasts here in the U.S., but it didn't garner the mass media attention that ISIS attacks in Belgium did last week. On Tuesday morning, explosions in a section of the airport and metro station in Brussels killed 35 people, wounded over 300 more. These attacks dominated cable news and other media outlets for the better part of last week. Our next guest says there's an imaginary red line when it comes to terror attacks internationally that leads to differences in media coverage of those attacks in different parts of the world. Joe Concha joins us now. He's a columnist for Mediaite. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Robert, thanks for having me. Can I call you Robert?
Sure, yeah. Rob works too. Tell us about this red line idea, Joe. Where is this sort of hypothetical line when it comes to how the media covers terrorist attacks?
I wish I can tell you exactly where it is. It's somewhere where the Middle East starts, I think. Anything west of there, if there is a terror attack, rightly, there is wall-to-wall coverage. We saw it with Paris. We saw it with Brussels. Certainly it was all justified given the death toll and the fact that we don't see attacks on soft targets like that from terror groups all that often. But we've seen it with Charlie Hebdo and obviously what happened in November at that rock concert hall outside a soccer stadium and outside of a cafe where 130 people were killed. Brussels, same deal. You're getting attacks not on airplanes but before security. In an airport, soft target, people killed there by two suicide bombers, and then obviously what happened in the subway as well. So, yes, that's big news, and no one begrudges covering that. But it was interesting that Turkey's attacks earlier this month on March 19th and March 13th, where more people died than people had perished in Brussels. And you hate to keep scoring these sort of things, and please, I don't want anybody to think that I'm insensitive in that regard. But that barely got any coverage because that is beyond that imaginary red line that we talked about earlier. It's over there. But Turkey is interesting, Rob, because it is a NATO country. It is visited by 42 million people per year. It's the sixth most popular tourist destination in the world. And two Americans were killed in those Turkey attacks. But I'm telling you, probably a lot of people in your audience right now are listening saying, there were attacks in Turkey? I really didn't hear much about that. So I found it interesting that I get it completely when there's an attack in Baghdad or Damascus or anywhere in Syria that it's not going to get coverage because that those are basically war zones. But when it happens in Turkey, which is a free market society that is a member of NATO, where two Americans are killed, and there wasn't as much coverage around that, it baffles me as to why that didn't get the coverage that Brussels did.
So is there a sense, do you think, that we want to hear the Europe story because we see Europeans as like us or closer to being like us than even not far from Western Europe over in Turkey?
I'm afraid so. I think there is a skin color aspect to this. Look at what goes on in Africa under Boko Haram, and they've killed more people than ISIS has, or at least that was the last stats that we have on such a thing. In 2014, they killed something like 6,900 people, and ISIS took 6,600 lives. But because it happens in Africa, which is on, again, that other side of that red line, wherever that may be, we don't cover it as much because, well, these are people that really aren't people we can relate to in terms of maybe its color of skin, maybe the fact there's no oil there. I'm not quite sure. Or maybe it just happens so often that we're numb by it, and then we say, you know what, let's just concentrate on Western civilization as opposed to Middle East and in Africa, where it's just a mess and there's nothing we can really do about it. I know that sounds callous. That's not my view. Mm-hmm. I'm just telling you about trying to get into the heads of the people that make these decisions as far as whether to cover it, and audiences, more importantly, who just don't really seem to care all that much what happens in those parts of the world.
Yeah, what does it do to us when we have the focus? I mean, we understand that if there's an attack, you know, San Bernardino in the United States, American media will focus on that. How does it skew our understanding of the world if we pay a lot of attention to that attack in Paris or Brussels, not as much to that attack in Turkey or in Africa or Pakistan?
Well, I think that it skews it in a sense where, ISIS is metastasizing, and it obviously is growing in scope and in terms of the type of neighborhoods that it's infiltrating outside of Paris or in Brussels or even in the United States, you can make an argument for. And I think we always thought that that sort of stuff happened on another side of the world, and only once in a while would it come to Western civilization, and okay, we'll deal with it if it only happens once in a while, but it seems to be happening more and more, so I think we should be paying more attention to what goes on in these places, because those types of people that are attacking there are now realizing that they can make a lot more waves if they attack Western targets. Easy to attack Western targets with people that are willing to strap bombs to themselves and blow themselves up. How do you stop that? I really have no idea, quite frankly. I was in a airport in New York, at LaGuardia Airport, and I was waiting to go through security, and the security line was maybe 20 feet from one of the main entrances from the street. And all I was doing, to be quite honest with you, I'm not the type of person who thinks about this stuff very often, but it was the day after Brussels, and you couldn't help but think about it. I kept looking for people walking through those doors, carrying a luggage carrier with one left black glove on their hands, the dead man's trigger, because I'm thinking, wow, there are 50 people sitting in a line right now, and somebody could just walk into here and just blow everything up, and there are people there with AK-47s, military people, they can't stop them. So it's a scary world we live in right now, and unfortunately what used to happen over there, over that red line, is happening more on this red line, but the media coverage doesn't quite match it.
Talking to Joe Concha about media coverage of terrorist attacks, so why we see more coverage here in the U.S. of something that might happen in Western Europe, in France, in Belgium, than a similar attack, maybe even a more deadly attack in Turkey, in Africa, in Pakistan has happened this weekend. You can join in, by the way, with your questions, your thoughts on this. Do you think it's bad that we have this imbalance in the way we cover things? You can call in at 800-642-1234. Joe, I'll throw another maybe theory at you about why we pay more attention to there in Europe. We see it maybe as a society like ours with a security apparatus like ours, like something that might be perceived as a target by ISIS like we would. So if it can happen there, it makes it more likely that it would happen here in a way that we wouldn't think that about attacks elsewhere in the world.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. The Turkey always throws me off because Istanbul, I don't know if you've ever visited, but it's a very kind of Western-feeling city. So, again, with two Americans being killed there, I'm just shocked that, I'm sure, again, I'd love to hear from your callers whether they heard about those attacks or not, or if they did, if it was just a fleeting kind of event in terms of coverage. What happened in Pakistan yesterday, that was certainly something that got some coverage, but it's already kind of gone away, and that was 70 dead, including 29 children that were just playing in a park on Easter Sunday, Christians that were targeted, and for whatever reason, that no one's rushing to send over an Aaron Burnett from CNN or a Shepard Smith from Fox to Pakistan to cover that, because again, that's an over there type of scenario. So, but I agree with your theory though that yes, Belgium is a lot like, let's say, New York, or Paris is a lot like New York, and it's the same type of security. I would say in New York, it's probably much more strong. I work there every day, but still, again, when you're a soft target, I don't see what stops somebody if they want to kill you and they want to, and they're willing to take their own lives, how you can stop them if they put their mind to it. And it's a scary, scary proposition.
Well, Joe, I think about social media. After the attacks in Paris, I think we saw some in Brussels too, a lot of hashtags or images that people shared a lot here in the U.S. I have seen people on social media say, okay, so why not, I stand with Turkey, or, you know, when these attacks happen. So there's a debate in some ways, not criticizing that people make those positive gestures in Europe, but why don't they in other countries? So social media reflects the old-fashioned media in some ways.
Yeah, you're exactly right about that. You don't see too many hashtags like we did after Charlie Hebdo, for instance, right? We did with Boko Haram for a little bit, courtesy of the First Lady. And I forget what the hashtag was exactly, but it kind of got ridiculed. It's like, oh, yeah, hashtag's going to make Boko Haram.
Save our girls, I think it was, right?
That's right, yeah. Exactly. Bring back our girls.
That was it.
To that extent, yes. So, but it's interesting you mentioned social media, because we're dealing with a terrorist enemy that, for the first time, has a very sophisticated media arm. Right, I mean, ISIS was able to celebrate Brussels literally minutes after it happened. They're sending out propaganda video all the time. They're using social media to recruit, as opposed to actually having to physically meet anybody, or at least even influence those that are willing to act on their behalf without any sort of training over in Syria or Iraq. So it's social media is really benefiting ISIS right now, and we're not doing very much to counter it in terms of propaganda of our own to make sure that these young people that are being swayed by ISIS via social media don't end up joining or at least acting on their behalf. And I think that's what happened in San Bernardino. I think that wasn't so much that anybody, you know, was under strict training, but more maybe influenced at least at first by social media before going over to overseas and then coming back. So that's another aspect of this, that you don't need to physically meet the head of ISIS or the head of ISIS training in order to act on behalf of ISIS, and that's because of social media.
Let's bring on our first caller now. Saeed is with us in Green Bay. Saeed, hi.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I think this imbalance you're talking about is not anything new, and in the net, it has a very detrimental effect on American understanding of this problem fundamentally. So let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. It wasn't until 9/11 that we became aware of that in a broad way in the United States and started talking about it. Yet this problem has been going on for a long, long time. And in 1979, the Islamist takeover of Iran had a very detrimental effect on that society. You know, people suffered tremendously, and that was unreported and still remains unreported. This is why you get the emergence of people like Donald Trump that blame all Muslims for the problems of a very few, and fundamentally this is an issue between within Islam, between backward-looking. I hesitate to use the term fundamentalist because I don't want to concede the fundamentals of the religion to them. But political, those who use Islam as a political tool, and the more mainstream, moderate Muslims who have struggled with this for a very long time. And that issue, so underreported, and the suffering of the people in the Middle East at the hands of these extremists, so underreported.
Saeed, thanks a lot for the call. And Joe, making the case that, if we're only paying attention when a group like ISIS attacks Europeans, we lose sight of the fact that Muslims suffer at their hands as much, actually probably more.
Oh, yes, absolutely. ISIS has killed more Muslims than any sort of drones or bombs that we've used by a long shot, right? Unless you conform to their very strict, very narrow ideology, then, yeah, they will start, they'll behead you. I know I read something last week where a child, a 7-year-old, was beheaded because he missed morning prayer. I mean, it's crazy. And you're right, that part doesn't get reported as well. It's something that we only concentrate on the Westerners of Brussels, of Paris, and we don't talk about the Muslims that are being executed on a daily basis in Iraq and Syria. It's just a horrible thing.
Talking to Joe Concha from Mediaite. He's a columnist there. He wrote a piece recently about the difference in media coverage of terrorist attacks in the Western world, United States, Europe in particular, and in other parts of the globe. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this difference in how the media covers terrorist attacks, depending on where they happen?
What, if anything, should the media change about how it covers terrorist attacks? What would you like to see done differently in that media coverage? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We pick up our discussion now with Joe Concha of Mediaite about the difference in how the media covers terrorist attacks in the West versus coverage of these attacks in the rest of the world. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts. Do you think any particular outlets do a better job of providing in-depth coverage when that terrorist attack isn't in Paris, say, or Brussels, but in Turkey, in Pakistan, in Africa? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Back to our callers now with Amy on the line in Appleton. Amy, hi.
Hi. I listen to the BBC World Service at night quite a bit, and I feel that a lot of the coverage below that red line we're discussing has a great deal to do with the leaders of those countries. I know Erdogan in Turkey has a stranglehold on anything that goes out. He's taken over the papers and the radio and everything else. And I think some of the leaders of Nigeria, for instance, you know, some of those men that run those countries don't want anyone to think things are as bad as they are, and they have a complete stranglehold in the news. BBC World Service complains about that quite a bit.
Amy, thanks for the call. What do you think, Joe?
That's a very excellent point, and I'll tell you why. So I talked about how 42 million people visited Turkey last year in 2015. They're already seeing a drop in tourism this year of about 6 or 7%, and that's mainly because there's been 6 terror attacks there over the last year. And certainly, when you're the 6th most visited country in the world, that's good money for your tourism business and therefore, obviously, your country. And some countries depend a lot more on tourism than, like, say, in Italy, for instance, than we realize. Probably want to make sure that everything's fine here. You'll be safe if you come. But as far as letting news get out, it's going to get out because of social media, right? I mean, you can't block that. And the Turkey story was reported. I think my point was that it would maybe got 1/30th the coverage that Brussels did, despite the fact that 2 Americans died in Brussels and 2 Americans died in Istanbul. But again, it was over there and not over here, so that's why it got much less coverage.
Amy, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Caitlin on the line in Madison. Caitlin, hi.
Hi. I guess my point is maybe this is a symptom of a larger problem where, unlike publicly funded media, we have advertisers that are funding news coverage, and thus the audience gets to dictate a lot of what's actually reported. So things like Kim Kardashian take precedence over attacks in Turkey, for instance.
But Caitlin, we do pay a lot of attention to attacks in Paris or Brussels, though. So it's more than just pop culture stuff crowding out those attacks, don't you think?
True. I would agree with that sentiment, but I guess my larger point is that the audience is dictating news coverage instead of an editorial board. They're not the ones setting the agenda, the audience is.
Gotcha. Interesting, Caitlin. So if people aren't clicking on that story about Pakistan, maybe we don't post another story on Pakistan, Joe.
Yeah, supply and demand, right? So I think Pakistan probably isn't as good an example as Turkey because there had been more terror attacks there, and they've obviously that's where Osama bin Laden was caught, and there's a big problem with the Taliban over there, clearly. They're the ones who carried out this attack yesterday. But to the corporate media incentive is the best way I could put it, side that was just broached. Yeah, I mean, our major media outlets here are corporate owned. They have shareholders to respond back to that they have to deliver for. And if Donald Trump, for instance, is bringing big ratings, and he is, every time he speaks, there's an uptick, or every debate that he's been in, they've doubled and tripled their numbers from 2012 or 2008. They're going to pay attention to a Trump, not because he's the most newsworthy guy. Yeah, he's a GOP frontrunner, but it's been so disproportionate in terms of the way he's been covered, not because he's the most interesting guy in the world, but because audiences are clamoring for it, and corporate media is simply giving them what they want because that means higher ratings. Higher ratings mean higher ad rates. Higher ad rates mean better stock price. So, yeah, that does play a role, no question about it.
Thanks for the call, Caitlin. We're talking to Joe Concha, columnist for Mediaite, about coverage of terrorist attacks around the world. In a recent piece, he wonders why we pay so much more attention in our American media to an attack in Western Europe than just about anywhere else on the planet. Back to our callers now with Randy on the line in Middleton. Randy, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. This is very insightful here. However, I think it's way too early to make any intelligent analysis of media coverage of the Pakistan attack. And there tends to be a template that, with so many media critics, that say we get all excited about any attack in Europe or the West, and they just kind of yawn about the attacks in Asia and Third World. And I think there's a lot of other things that work there, and one of them somebody has already talked about. In Turkey, it's very hard to get the press in there. And I imagine it's quite a bit harder to get the press in Pakistan. You can get reporters to Brussels and Paris relatively easy. And so they can give first-hand accounts, whereas I think you're getting a lot of second-hand coverage of the other places. I think that's partly just a matter of where you have your people allocated.
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. But I guess, Joe, the other thought there is, why do we have more resources allocated to Europe in the first place than the other countries we're talking about?
Right, yeah, you helped make my point for me. And it's a good point. You know, it's harder to get a reporter into Islamabad, for instance, or Lahore than say, Brussels. I totally get that. It's much further away. Obviously, there's a cost aspect as well. And, yeah, it's not quite as friendly to journalists. And maybe a lot of journalists don't want to go there anyway, given what happened to Daniel Pearl and so on. It's not exactly what people are running for. But I would like to just see at least an attempt made. You know, I mean, you can report from Istanbul. If CNN wants to go there and Jeff Zucker wants to send Aaron Burnett there, he can get her over there. Or if Roger Ailes wants to get Shep Smith into Istanbul, same deal. But the attempt isn't even made, because I think the calculation is that the audience is going to see that, say, Turkey, predominantly a Muslim country, that stuff happens there all the time, and the low information audience just says, I'm not really interested. But Brussels, I was going to go on vacation there next year. That affects me. Maybe I want to see a little bit more of that. So that's my two cents on that one.
Randy, thanks for the call. Joe,
thanks,
in our
Randy.
Last couple minutes, what's your prescription? What would you tell the editor, the producer who's making these decisions?
I would say that this is an important story, that sometimes we can't be totally ratings-driven. And just to try to – I know it's never going to – Paris is never going to match a Pakistan if the attacks are the same. I totally get that. But the fact that it's – from what I've seen, and I can't quantify it right now, but by the end of the week I'll probably have strong numbers on this, at least try to cover it, half as much. Or at least a quarter as much, but it's like 1/10 as much, 1/20 as much. Boko Haram, barely. I bet you could ask 100 people on the street who they are, and 80 of them won't be able to identify them. And they're the most deadly terror group out there right now, and somebody that we should be something we should be paying attention to. So all I'm saying is make more of an effort. I understand there are ratings and there's profits involved, but let's make more of an effort, because these are important things. And again, what's happening over there is happening over here more, and we better be paying more attention to what's happening over there before it starts happening over here more, so we have a better understanding of who the enemy is and what their goal is.
And we've heard from some listeners who agree with you. Briefly, as we wrap up, do you think what would they do to encourage their media outlets to do more on this?
Social media. It's great. Before, you used to have to, take out a pen or a typewriter and write a letter and hope that, somebody read it when you sent it in to a news station or to a newspaper. And now with social media, you could get in touch with reporters directly. You could get in touch with producers or even the people that run these networks pretty easily. And they all read this stuff, believe it or not. You'd be surprised. So social media is the megaphone to voice your concerns or what you want to see more on television. And trust me, those executives and those reporters, they're paying attention.
Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Joe Concha. He's a columnist at Mediaite with us to talk about the differences in how the media is covering terrorist attacks in Belgium and in Pakistan. We've got a piece he wrote, by the way, linked on the Central Time Facebook page.